The following message is from Christ Community Church in Athens, Georgia. For more information and sermons, go to www.christ-community.com. Thank you for listening.
Let's hear from Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
I came across an article this week, and it was called Five Ways to Live the Good Life, and it was written by a woman named Vanessa Van Edwards, and she wrote a book last year, it was one of my favorite books of 2017, called Captivate. If you are in the business of people, and I don't care what you are, it's a fantastic book on the science of connecting with people. And so her website is The Science of People, and on that website, here's this blog on five ways to live the good life. And she says, look, we all want to live a life that is, you know, relatively healthy and happy. That's kind of her broad definition of the good life. I think we all get that. And I thought for a minute about reading through all five of those, but she basically says all five of these ways to a good life are connected back to this practice of gratitude. That in a world where we don't have everything that we want, sometimes not everything that we need, the best thing that we can do if we want to live a good life and to live a relatively fulfilled, relatively happy life is to be grateful for the things that we have. And I think there's something good and right about that. I think it's incomplete and insufficient. We'll talk about that. But we all want to live the good life. I mean, this is what Psalm 23 is about. And we started this conversation last week talking about what this looks like, but the good life, and when we're talking about this, we're not talking about something that is some strictly sectarian way of life. We're talking about what it means to be fully human, what it means to be fully alive. And so what we saw in Psalm 23 at the beginning last week is the good life is a life in which you and I have everything we need right now, no matter what's happening in our world or inside us or around us. That's the good life. That's simple enough to understand. There are no complex words there. But that's hard to swallow, right? Because we are surrounded by scarcity. And that's scary. And so the specific question that I want to wrestle with today is, in a world where we don't have all the good things that we need, or we can look around us and see that other people don't have all the good things that they need, how do we live without fear? How do we live the good life? How do we live a life in which, even when we don't have all the good things, we still live confidently, with hope? Here's the answer. You'll see this on the screen, so if you're a note taker, this will help you. How do I live the good life? You trust God and you be yourself. We started this last week. We said, you know, you take the first few verses of Psalm 23 and how do I live the good life? I trust God. And then today, we just want to build on that, talk about that a little bit more, and then we want to talk about this idea of being yourself. So I want to dig in, and specifically where I want to dig in Psalm 23 is in verse 4. So in verse 4, some of us grew up learning this in the King James. There's a yay in there somewhere, but we'll just read it here in the English Standard Version. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. So the phrase, the valley of the shadow, is actually one word in the original language, and it means deep darkness. And so what we're saying here is that even when we find ourselves in the deepest valley that we can imagine, you know, a physical darkness where you can't see your hand in front of your face, the dark night of the soul, when you and I find ourselves in the deepest darkness that we could ever experience or possibly imagine, you and I will fear no evil. We will not be afraid. Why? Because God is with us. So when we talk about the good life, we said last week, the good life is a full life because God gives us all that we need. And today what we're going to say is that the good life is fearless because God is with us. So let me go ahead and show my cards here. And as we talk about a life that is true for all of humanity, what we're going to say and what I'm going to say as a Christian minister is that the only way that you and I are ever going to experience the good life is if we believe that this is a life that is absolutely conditioned upon the work that God is doing on our behalf. The good life is full. God provides. The good life is fearless because God is with us. Simple. Yet almost impossible for us to grasp, almost impossible for us to live out. We need to talk about death a little bit because it's here in the text, and we're a fairly young church, and while I think all of us know pain and loneliness, and some of us have experienced the pain and loneliness of burying somebody who we love, of watching somebody that we love die, in terms of our experience together as a church, in the 14 years that I've been here, there have been two funerals that I've officiated in 14 years. But there's something here that's helpful for all of us because it doesn't say here, even though I walk through the valley of death, it says I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. So whether or not you are intimately acquainted with death because of the work that you do or because of just the nature of your own life personally, all of us have experienced the shadow of death. The fear that death is coming. If you've ever experienced pain, if you've ever experienced loneliness, it is a trigger and a tell that tells you that death is coming and you can't avoid it. And unless you're a sociopath, that's scary. And developmentally, the way in which we experience fear related to death is it's different. Like when you're growing up and you're watching cartoons and Wile E. Coyote and Elmer Fudd and Daffy Duck are getting blown away and they die a million deaths in, you know, a million different ways, you just look at that and go, okay, that's cartoons. It doesn't create a lot of fear. Somehow it creates a lot of laughs. And maybe some of us growing up that we had somebody, a distant relative, a grandparent we weren't very close with. We had to go to a great aunt's funeral. And so we knew that death existed, but it didn't create fear. Some of us, as we got older, we become more acquainted with death. It's the death of a loved one who's close to us, a parent, a grandparent who raised us, a friend in the same life stage. It's the high schooler who drowns in a lake. It's the high schooler who gets killed in a car wreck. It's, you know, a mom who's in her 20s or 30s who contracts cancer, and that shouldn't happen, and it's just so weird and out of step, and it shocks you. But then as you get older, as that five-year reunion turns into a 25-year reunion, at your 50th high school reunion, you're wondering who's left. Because death is coming. If my brother-in-law is here, he'd be laughing because some of you remember the movie Pollyanna, and Carl Malden played a Presbyterian minister, and my brother-in-law, who's a Baptist deacon, likes to every now and then, you know, take a line out of that movie and say it every now and then when I'm being Presbyterianish and be like, "Death comes unexpectedly." That's the line. And it's true for a lot of us. Death's coming, and it's scary. And you watch how people respond to the fear of death. Some people deny it. And we say, look, that's a healthy part of the grieving process. You deny it. It just gets weird if you continue to deny it years later. Some people, the way in which they're going to respond to death and the fear of death is through self-indulgence. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. The Apostle Paul said it, quoting another poet, and Dave Matthews grabbed it later. I remember the there's a cartoon in Field of Stream magazine that one of my father-in-law's coaches, football coach, had in his office, and it's this picture of a lake, and there are some mountains behind it, and there are three big mushroom clouds from nuclear explosions, and you see this boat on the lake and two guys fishing, and the caption is, "You know what this means, Norm? There are no limits, and screw the size restrictions." Just whatever, death's coming, so let's just live it up. Or you see people live in despair. It's the approach of nihilism, and you have an entire TV show that some of us love called Seinfeld that's about absolutely nothing, because what nothing matters, right? It's the high school student who gets into a little philosophy and walks into the English, into their English teacher's office and says, "So I don't have a paper to give to you because the truth of the matter is that this whole thing's purposeless. I'm going to learn a bunch of stuff and then I'm going to die and then all of it's going to be lost." Some of us look at life and go, I have a shelf life. I have some time here and death is going to come, so I need to make the most out of it. There's all kinds of things I could do with my time and my energy. What really is going to matter? How do I not waste it? This could be a bucket list. This could just be you going, look, I mean, I have one shot at this, and how do I make the most out of it? We all respond to it, right, in different ways, but what we can't change is the fact that it's going to come. And that's scary. But what we're saying and what we're seeing here in Psalm 23 is that there is a life that we're calling the good life. That from our perspective, we say Christianity and the way of Jesus is the only one that can promise and secure this life. That says that when you live in the shadow of death, you don't have to be afraid. Now, there's nothing wrong with fear. Fear is a natural, healthy emotion. It brings strength because whenever you find yourself frightened by something, it reminds you that you're vulnerable, and oftentimes you'll have to ask for help, and usually that over time will be the thing that cultivates wisdom. What we're talking about is when fear devolves into anxiety, not garden variety worry, which says, you know what, I should probably pay attention to that, but the kind of thing where you're like, look, this isn't a good thing, I need to pay attention to it, but I think by paying attention to it and thinking really, really hard about it and trying really, really hard that I can control the situation and change it. It's me staying up at night, freaked out about whatever it is that I think is going to happen or what is really happening right now. Or it's rage. Not just being angry, because there are times when we need to be angry because things aren't right in this world. It's when we are enraged by those things, when the best question that you can ask when somebody just flies off the handle, probably once they settle down, is, okay, so what are you afraid of? This is what we're talking about. We're talking about a life that says that you don't have to stay afraid when things come that are scary. That there's a way of life that helps you transition from fear into faith. That's the good life. But I was thinking about, because none of that seems complicated to me. None of that seems challenging. Like, it seems challenging in the moments when things are threatening and scary, but on the surface going, look, the best way to live is a life where we believe when scary things come, we don't have to anxiety ourselves to death or go into a rage. Why? Because God is with us. So why is it so hard for me to actually do that? Well, I think something that's helpful here that I think it's easy to pass over in verse 4 is that it says, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Not, it doesn't say even though I walk into the valley of the shadow of death. It says I walk through it. It means that I'm not going to stay there. And so what happens is that when I get this wrong, when I start to look at life or what could possibly happen in life, what could happen a year from now, a decade from now, what could happen in my personal life, what could happen in my professional life, when I begin to get anxious or when I begin to get angry, the reason why I am stuck is because I haven't figured out a way to get through the valley. Now, here's what it sounds like sometimes when we get stuck. These are just four common ways I think we get stuck in the valley when we find ourselves in this deep pit of despair. Sometimes, and some of us are wired to say things like this, well, I mean, I'm here because I think I deserve this. You know, it's the meme of this is why we can't have good things, right? But there are some of us who, when things happen to us that just aren't good, we just go, well, I mean, you know, you just look back at my history and I just think I'm the kind of person that I don't deserve nice things. Like, this is what I deserve. This is what I should have. Some of us get stuck because we like the attention that comes to us when we're in the valley. No human being has ever been noticed too much. And some of us feel like nobody even knows we exist. And there are these moments when tragedy happens around us. Certainly things like being widowed or losing a job or cancer. Like, there are people that I know who have made up stories about contracting cancer. Some injustice that's happened to you, and people care about you, they pay attention to you, they check in on you, they want to know how you're doing, they're praying for you. And you don't want to leave there because you're afraid that if I don't bring it up, or if people don't know that this is happening to me, even though we've talked about it and we've processed it and we've been through that the entire time, if that doesn't happen, then nobody's going to pay attention to me anymore. This is my thing. This is why people pay attention to me. Some of us get stuck because we have a hard time moving on. And certainly you can think of this in terms of some, you know, friends of yours that you may know who are widowed, and that's difficult and challenging. I think more of Uncle Rico and Napoleon Dynamite. Here's this thing that I was known for 30 years ago when I was a high schooler, and now I'm in my 40s, and I'm still living out that way. And that's how some of us are approaching life, that we have this thing that we were known for, and I can't move on, and even though I know it's kind of ridiculous that this is the thing for me, it's the person who, as they age, they continue to act or try to dress like they are 25, when you're not 25 anymore. And everybody can see it except you. But you can't give up on that. Because if I don't, like, what happens when I lose my identity? I don't know why, but I've listened to two books. One was Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff, and then a new book on Apollo 8, so space astronaut stuff. Takes me straight back to sixth grade when I wanted to do space camp, the whole thing. But one of the things that was interesting is the wives of those astronauts, and one of the fear that was not consistently true but showed up seemingly at every turn was, if my husband dies, who am I now? Because I am an astronaut's wife. And that comes with a level of notoriety. And who am I if they die and they go away? So sometimes we have a hard time moving on. Some people, they don't know who they are without this thing. So I was thinking about this and the struggle that some people have to move on when they get, and this is why they get stuck. And I was thinking the first time that in Birmingham, I had two people whose spouses had died, and then they got remarried. And it happened fast, like the remarriage happened fast. And so, you know, I'm in my mid-20s, barely married myself. And I'm going, is that a good thing? I mean, y'all married a long time, and then all of a sudden you just turn the corner, and boom, we're just going to get married. And so I can remember talking to a mentor of mine and said, hey, what do you think about this? And he said, it doesn't surprise me. And I mean, I don't know the situation, but it's probably a good thing for two reasons. Number one, people who've been in good marriages know that marriage is good. So it makes sense that they'd want to be married again. But secondly, I find it particularly helpful that they didn't just stay stuck, that they were able to grieve and move on. Now, that may not, none of those things may resonate with you. And I think that if you find yourself, and when you find yourself stuck in the valley, you have to wrestle with, why am I stuck? Why do I believe that I can't move forward? Okay? That's helpful, just to have situational clarity and awareness. But it's not going to ultimately answer the question, which is, how do we keep moving through the valley? How do we get unstuck when we get stuck? And how do we make sure that when we find ourselves there, if we're not there today, that we keep moving? Because again, this isn't talking about how do you handle being on your deathbed. This is when you find yourselves in a pit of despair. How do you move through it? You may find yourself there today. It may happen tomorrow. It may be coming next week, next month, next year, but it's coming. And so how do you keep moving? How do you live the good life? What did we say? Two things. This is how I live the good life. This is how I get stuck when I find myself in the valley. You trust God, and you be yourself. We said last week, we talked about this whole idea of trusting God, and we said, this is the way it works. We look at verse 1 of Psalm 23, and it says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. There is a God, and that God provides for my needs. And that creates a way of us thinking about life in which it says that there is a God who is going to take care of me. And we've said that is very good and very real. It will not be enough to help you survive the hurricane when life doesn't make sense, when you've done seemingly your part and what you're getting back from the universe, from life, doesn't seem to be fair. This is the kind of faith that creates cynics and skeptics. It creates a world in which we can't get past the idea that, sure, there's a God, but life isn't fair, and I believe there's a God, so it must be God's fault. I don't want us to miss the goodness of this kind of transactional faith. I will say this, that one of my concerns for us as parents is that we undersell the goodness of a transactional faith where our sons and daughters look at God and say, there is a God and he will take care of me. And we expect them to have a different kind of faith that they haven't had to experience yet because they haven't experienced the hurricane yet. And so I think we find themselves when we try to figure out, is my child a Christian? And we're trying to wrestle with issues of baptism and when should my child be baptized and what kind of faith should they have? And I would say, there's real transactional faith. There is a God. He takes care of me. He provides for me. That is good and right. And we don't even look at it as sub-Christian. But we are going to say, if you stay there and you get no further than that in life, you're going to have a really hard time doing what I think we're encouraged to do here in Psalm 23, verse 4, which is not just to say I'm going to trust God, but to say I'm going to trust God right now. And look at the encouragements that are in Psalm 23 to encourage you that no matter what's going on in your life, in the deepest darkness that you ever have or ever will or are experiencing today, you can and should trust God right now. Number one, because of what's sitting there right in front of you, because he is with you. You are not alone. Even if nobody in the universe knows what you're going through right now, you're not alone. He's with you. And then there's this language at the end of verse 4, talking with sort of shepherd precision about your rod and your staff. They comfort me. I can trust God right now because he protects me. This rod is this custom design. If you want to know the best way that I know in our culture to think about a shepherd's rod is to think of Thor's hammer. Because occasionally they would swing it and sometimes they would throw it. Sometimes they would throw it at things. Sometimes they would use it to protect sheep from themselves. But that sense that there is a God who is going to protect me from things happening outside of me and things happening inside of me. I can trust him right now. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. The shepherd's staff with a little crook in it that would grab newborn baby lambs who are almost about to get trampled because their little legs can't go as fast as everybody else and the other sheep aren't paying attention and they can't keep up with mama, and so the shepherd would scoop them up. Sheep are nasty animals. They have to be inspected and checked, and is everything okay? And so the shepherd would grab the sheep and come over, bring them over, particularly the shy sheep, and bring them over there because they aren't going to come. They're going to run away, and so he'd have to grab them, bring them back, providing for them. Sheep don't know which way to go, especially when it's a new path, and so you'd basically turn that staff around, use the pointy end of it, and you just kind of poke them. You would poke them hard, just kind of pointing them in the right direction. You can trust God because he provides for you, provides direction for you. He cares deeply and intimately about the details of your life. You can trust him right now because he will bless you. You can look at verse 5 when it says, you prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. And if you've been around this psalm before, and I don't know what the imagery that you have of this scene, I don't know if it's a scene of there's this great big battle that's going on, and there's this like, this dining room table, and you're having a meal there. I don't know if it's sort of a way that you think about it is that my enemies are trying to get me, and God's providing for me, and ha-ha on all of you. Look at what I have, and look what you don't have. One writer puts it in a way that I found encouraging and helpful, particularly for who we want to be in this world. I've said this a lot in the past few weeks to several people, that if you want one single way to identify your health as either a Christian or a human, how well do you love your enemies? How well do you love people different than you? How well do you love people who believe different than you, who look different than you, who don't see the world the same way that you do? And the reason I believe that's true is because Jesus says that if you want to love God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength, then you do that by loving your neighbor as yourself. And who is my neighbor? Well, he seems to talk a lot about loving your enemies. So what if what we have here is a God who blesses us so much that we are just overwhelmed by the generosity of God? So much generosity that we're overwhelmed with gratitude for him, that it creates a grace in us that says, hey, I have all this stuff, and I know you and I don't get along, but would you like some? Now, you and I have nothing about us that says that's how we're wired. But this is the reason we can trust our God. He blesses you this much that you can trust him right now, even when it comes to be generous to your enemies. I don't find this complicated, but I find it impossible to live out. Why am I unable to trust God like this? Right now, no matter what's happening, no matter what's going on inside of me, no matter what's going on around me, in my deepest valley, if I want to live the life that I've been created to live, if I want to be fully human, I need to trust God right now. Faith grows in the soil of desperation. Faith grows, matures from a transactional faith into a trusting faith that allows us to look at Psalm 46, which we use as our call to worship for those of us who are here. And in that psalm, this is what we read. This is what we hear. This is what we said, too, because we're Presbyterians and we don't get much more than a. But this is what we said. God is our refuge and strength. Yay! A very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, no matter what happens, I can trust God right now. But I won't, and here's why. The question that I have to wrestle with is, why do I get so scared in those moments? Why do I get so anxious in the valley of the shadow of death? Why do I get so angry when not only things don't go my way, but I feel threatened? When I feel like the good of the people that I love is threatened? When I think that the good of the world around me is threatened? Why does that happen? It's because I'm scared. And you weren't created to be scared. Not like that. So if I'm going to become a person who trusts God right now, no matter what's happening, I have to be myself. We said if you're going to live the good life, you need to trust God and be yourself. So we need to talk about what in the world that means to be yourself. And so what we're talking about is bring all of your life here. Here's your anger, here's your anxiety. You weren't made for that. You weren't made to live that way. That's not who you were made to be. What we're talking about is in that moment when I find myself in the valley, I find myself, and fear is there. I am afraid, okay? I'm situationally aware of reality, and I feel fear. Will I run towards God and trust him, or will I run away from him? You were created as a human being to trust God. That is your default operating system, but you and I and everybody breathing air has a bug in our system that we call both our sin, what we do, and our sinfulness, how we're now wired, which predisposes us that when we find ourselves afraid, we will not run towards God, we will run away from him every time. Because we panic. And we feel like we have to grab control of our situation, of our lives, of our world as it spins out of control. And we begin to trust ourselves in two ways. Either we trust our desires, these incredibly good things that God gives us that make terrible gods. Our desires, where Jesus says, hey, I think we can all agree that you shouldn't kill people. Everybody head nods that one. We know the commandment, you don't kill people. And then he says, but you know when you get cut off in traffic and you call somebody a name? When you talk about people, think about people, feel about people in dehumanizing ways, there's no difference. Because in that moment, you're ignoring me, you're using people, and you're not who you were made to be. You were made to become love, not that. Jesus says, you know the whole thing about not committing adultery? I think we can all agree that it's probably not good for the world. I'm telling you is that when you sit there and you let your thoughts and heart linger towards somebody else, thinking about them in ways related to sex and sexuality that really aren't about them and their good, it's about you. It's no different. Because you're ignoring me in the way that I created sex and sexuality, you're using them, you don't care about them, and that's not who I made you to be. See, this is how you and I break the world. In this moment, when we get afraid, when we choose anxiety, when we choose anger, when we let our desires just have their way, or when we go, hey, pal, that's not how I'm wired. I am Mr. Responsible. I have a strong willpower. I don't do those kind of things. I don't think in those kind of ways. And you've got a track record that says, yeah, you're a pretty good person. I'm going to comb through all that and go, I want you to tell me about that spot in your heart and in your head and where you're like, except for that one time, and except for that one part of me, and go, see? And it's in that spot where you go, I can fix it, that you ignore God in the same way that every single one of us as parents have had to deal with great exasperation at a child who's like, I can do this by myself. Dude, you are 2 years old. That is a 50-pound can of laundry detergent from Costco that your grandparents bought. You can't move that. We use people. Broken people will break people. And when we run away from God, we will hurt other people. And we won't be ourselves. A lot of us have seen the Snickers commercials. This is the Snickers commercial. You're not yourself. You weren't made for anxiety. When somebody says, well, he's just an angry person, it's not true. So how do we get through the valley? It can't be by walking out of here with better desires and with a better plan of action. Because then you're just running away from God. You're ignoring him. And you'll hurt people and you won't be who you were made to be. Jesus comes along and he says, hey, if you want to walk with me out of the valley, I need you to do three things. First, I need you to deny yourself. Now, we hear that and we think, well, what about my uniqueness? And what about my, like, who I am and my story and my personality and my Enneagram and my Myers-Briggs and, you know, what I like to do for work and all this kind of thing and my specialness? He's not saying the death of yourself. He's saying the death towards yourself. It is the denial of everything that you think makes you you that is a bunch of hogwash. It's not who you are. You just think that's who you have to be in order to make it in this world. So he says, deny yourself, take up your cross. Who goes on crosses? Rebels. Take every rebellious part of you and kill it dead. So there is this text that the Apostle Paul, when he writes to the church in Corinth, where he says, look, let me make this real simple for y'all. Now, it's not going to sound simple for us because Paul doesn't write very simply. He says, for the love of Christ controls us. Okay? Jesus loves you, so that should shape your life. Because we have concluded this, that one has died for all, Jesus died for all of us, therefore all have died. And he died for all, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised. Translation, you don't live for you, you live for Jesus. Okay? Not complicated. And in case you're wondering what that looks like, the third thing that Jesus says after saying, deny yourself, take up your cross, he says, follow me. We live for him. And what we are going to continue to try to keep as simple as we possibly can is the wisdom and the brilliance of the way of Jesus. He says, look, for centuries, we've been saying this. The Lord our God, the same Lord that you see here in verse 1 of Psalm 23, Yahweh, is the God of gods, the King of kings, the Lord of lords, and he loves you. And because he loves you, the most natural, the most human response you can have is to love this God with every fiber of your being. And the way in which you love him with every fiber of your being primarily is by loving the people he puts around you as much as you love yourself. That's the way of Jesus. This is the way we go through the valley, right? This is the good life. This is the life that says, my cup overflows, Psalm 23, verse 5. So there is so much generosity and grace coming towards me that I have generosity and grace to give towards people. I do not have to be a slave to fear because I do not find myself living in the valley as a permanent resident. I'm just passing through. You're all smart people with brains that could put this together logically. But we have to experience this or else we're going to tuck this away as either something to write off or something to think about later. So I need you to walk with me into a garden, like the botanical gardens. And I need you to see Jesus by himself, all alone. Physically, his closest friends have fallen asleep on him. Emotionally, psychologically, I need you to see him praying. I need you to see that the scriptures say, as strange as it might sound, he sweats blood because he's scared. Why is he scared? People went to the cross cussing and screaming, no fear, fighting to their very last breath. I don't think it's about the physical pain of the cross. I think the key is here in Psalm 23, verse 4. This promise that God gives, the promise of promises that I will be with you. There's a man named Isaac. Isaac's father Abraham dies, and God comes and says, I made this promise to your father, and I'm going to make it to you as well. This land, all of it is yours, and I will be with you. God looks at Isaac's son Jacob years later and reminds him that I will never leave you, I will be with you. Jacob's son Joseph, on his deathbed, surrounded by his family, says, look, I'm going to die, and I just need all of you to remember the Lord will be with you. Centuries later, when God's people are living, millions of people living in slavery, this one man, Moses, that God chooses to use to bring his people out of slavery, God takes a man scared out of his mind and says, you can do this because I will be with you. This is the storyline from Genesis 12 onward. I will bless you because I will be with you. And what you have is the people of God continuing to bank their life on the reality that God is with them. And then there's this birth of this baby who an angel comes to a poor virgin woman and says, you should call him Jesus. He's Emmanuel. God is with you. And as a church, we bank everything on the fact that Jesus is with us, that we believe that he's here with us. And it doesn't, as strange as it might sound, because there's not, like, if I go, hey, Jesus, I know everybody's going to look over here at Christian and go, that probably is what Jesus looks like, right? That's what we got. He's not in this room physically, but think of what good news that is. Because if there was a Jesus that was limited by his physical reality, he would be somewhere, and he might be here, but he's just as likely to be somewhere else. But a Jesus who isn't restricted by physical realities can tell us, I'm with you, and he actually can be. And we bank our life on it. We bank our life on the promise of Jesus before he returned to heaven when he said, I will be with you until the end of this world. And at the end of this world, then I will be with you. And I will wipe away every single tear, not just from those people or those people, but from your eyes. But the reason that's true has to do with everything that happens in that garden and everything that happens on the cross. Because what led Jesus to a fear like we have experienced, but deeper than anything we could possibly ever fathom, is that what we believe that what happens on the cross is that in the moment on the cross, Jesus found himself abandoned by God. God was not with him because of your sin and my sin. Not because of anything he did, but because of you and me. But because he was abandoned, because God was not with him, there is never a nanosecond in your experience in this life where you ever have to wonder or doubt whether God is with you. When you walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you have nothing to fear. You can trust God. He will be with you. That's our hope. That's the good life.